The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, my name is Naomi Lambert from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share articles with you from the Assembly, which publishes in-depth reporting on North Carolina at theassemblync.com. We're starting today with an article entitled, Why Did NC's Budget Take So Long? And it's an article by Brian Anderson. State lawmakers sent Governor Josh Stein a comprehensive budget on Thursday. That would be the beginning of July, ending a year-long impasse between House and Senate Republicans. The bill advanced out of the General Assembly with substantial bipartisan support, including about half of Democrats in each chamber during an initial vote on Wednesday and final procedural vote on Thursday. The budget, which cleared the House 88-21 and the Senate 35-10 on its last consideration, will almost certainly become law. Either Stein will sign it or allow it to become law without his signature after 10 days. Stein said he wouldn't act on the budget this week as his office is still combing through the provisions, but he did voice frustration with the process. The fact that we haven't had a full budget in 2.5 years is a real indictment, Stein told reporters on Thursday. We're the only state in the country that didn't pass a budget last year. We haven't passed a budget in 2.5 years. I'm glad that they finally have. We're going to review it carefully, and I look forward to talking about it more next week. There are several provisions likely to appeal to the governor. The spending plan includes substantial teacher pay raises, with starting wages rising from $41,000 a year to $48,000. On average, teachers will see an 8% salary increase before state and local supplements. Corrections officers, law enforcement personnel, and others will see even greater increases. Most state workers, however, will get a more modest 3% raise, while retirees will get a 2.5% cost of living adjustment. While House Republicans wanted the raises to be retroactive to the previous fiscal year, they compromised with the Senate by agreeing to make them start in the fiscal year that began on July 1st. Many workers will also receive one-time bonuses. A number of Stein's other top priorities made their way into the final budget. The governor asked lawmakers for $792 million for Hurricane Helene relief. The budget sets aside $700 million. He also asked lawmakers to include $5 million for the Sun Bucks program, a U.S. Department of Agriculture initiative that provides parents a one-time credit of $120 per eligible child for food when school is out in the summer. Lawmakers funded the request for this fiscal year, but Stein wanted it to be recurring. One notable GOP priority that the budget excludes is a separate elections bill that the governor disliked. Unlike many prior budgets, this year's plan doesn't pursue any major changes to election law. House Speaker Destin Hall and Senate Leader Phil Berger said they couldn't recall a previous time the legislature passed a budget that didn't at least make some election changes. It does include funding for 14 new positions at the State Board of Elections and $15 million to modernize the election management system. We got to a good place on a good product, said Senator Ralph Hise, a Mitchell County Republican and top budget negotiator. Budgets are not to solve all the problems of the state. We've got a lot of work left to do on various issues, but I think we got to a good end. Bucking the budget line. The spending plan wasn't without its critics, even from within the GOP. In a rare break from their party, two coastal Republicans opposed the budget over concerns with a provision adding tolls to all ferry routes starting in 2027. Coastal residents have the option of buying a $150 annual pass instead. But for Senators Bobby Hannig of Currituck County and Norman Sanderson of Pamlico County, the provision was a poison pill. I made a promise to my constituents a long time ago that I would not vote for a ferry tax, Hannig said during floor debate. A state senator hasn't defected from the caucus on an enacted comprehensive budget since 2013, and no House Republican has bucked the party on an enacted budget since 2014. Hannig wasn't present for the procedural vote on Thursday, while Sanderson voted in support on a final consideration. Many of the budget's Democratic critics objected to the process, saying they wanted to be involved in drafting the legislation, or that Republicans had resolved the impasse sooner. Cuts to vacant state government jobs are too sweeping, they said, and state worker raises should be higher. They also felt healthcare initiatives such as the Healthy Opportunities Pilot Program deserved more funding. But in the end, many ultimately came around to voting for the budget. Democratic Republican Amos Quick of Guilford County summed up his position most creatively. "I will vote for this budget, but with the same enthusiasm as I do eating bad food." House Democratic leader Robert Reeves said the House's initial proposal last year was the best budget he had seen since he took office in 2014. He blamed the Senate for making changes that undermined the more sweeping raises the House had pursued. He also cited the looming power vacuum the Berger's primary defeat has created as an opportunity to improve relations between the two chambers. "The Senate's going to be a brand new place next year," Reeves said. "Let's remind them of what good government looks like." Why did it take so long? It had been 1,014 days since lawmakers last sent a comprehensive budget to the governor. In 2023, Berger folded on his goal of bringing a casino to Rockingham County, which had become a major sticking point in deliberations with then-House Speaker Tim Moore. The two leaders couldn't reach consensus the following year on budget adjustments for the short session. When Hall took the House gavel in 2025, there was optimism that a fresh face could develop a better rapport, but that has not materialized. The Senate saw little incentive to renegotiate agreements it had reached in the 2023 budget on tax cuts and a children's hospital. House negotiators proved equally stubborn on teacher and state worker pay raises. The result, talks collapsed last year, and discussions were reset after Berger lost his primary to Rockingham County Sheriff Sam Page. As the short session got underway this spring, the intransigence appeared to subside, perhaps in recognition of the political consequences inaction could have in this November's election. "They knew that North Carolinians were fed up with their inaction and ineffectiveness," said Senate Democratic leader Sidney Batch. "I don't think that they did it because they felt like they had to. I think they did it because they're really worried about what the November election looks like and Democrats coming back in charge." After some uncertainty in late April and early May, Berger and Hall unveiled a framework for moving forward and set a target of passing the budget the week of June 15th. That self-imposed deadline got kicked back a couple of weeks as they resolved outstanding disagreements. Republican State Representative John Blust, whose Guilford County district overlaps with Berger's, pinned the blame on the Senate leader, referring to his chamber as a majority of one. "I don't like the delay," Blust said. "I don't know how to make them move quicker." Berger blamed the House for the lengthy process, saying Hall took longer than his predecessor to begin negotiations last year. "When we started the session, we were ready to get to work," Berger said. "The House published a calendar that showed that they were going to work a couple of days a week. The Senate was here, prepared to work more full time. Once we were able to get into a room and begin meetings, we were able to move things along." Two of the biggest issues left unaddressed. The Senate wanted to fund a possible Major League Baseball expansion team in Raleigh, and the House wanted to defund NC Innovation, a non-profit meant to help commercialize university research. In hindsight, House and Senate leaders recognized the budget process was far more difficult than it needed to be, and it's not sustainable. "I can't say that I thought that it would go on for as long as it did, and that's unfortunate that it did. But I also knew that my position and the position of our caucus was resolute," Hall told reporters this week. "We just weren't going to settle for anything less than having some real raises in this budget and fixing that tax package," he continued. I hope in the future that it doesn't take as long, and hopefully everybody in this chamber and the other one learn some lessons, and we can get it done much quicker next time. Berger said he wished the House had made its view on the MLB stadium funding clearer months earlier, but ultimately felt it wasn't worth holding up the budget to resolve. We never had a response from the House as to what their position was, Berger told reporters. When it became clear that their position was that they were not going to be interested in moving forward, it was important for us to just recognize that, acknowledge that, and get on with the other things. Well, we're moving on now to culture and history. The man who put the Outer Banks on the map. And this is an article by John Rayleigh and Nancy Beach Gray. What an appropriate name. This is an excerpt from a new book, Acock Brown on the Outer Banks. Imagine the Outer Banks with vast, beguiling, barren stretches of beach running for miles. Cottages on stilts here and there along a two-lane road by the sea. No TVs, few phones save for pay phones in their glass boxes in random parking lots. A handful of local grocery stores, not supermarkets. Mom and pop motels and just a few majestic hotels. And a few thousand visitors, mostly from the nearby coastal plain of North Carolina and the tidewater region of Virginia, in a short summer season from Memorial Day to Labor Day, served by a few thousand locals, along with summer help from high school and college kids. How did the banks get from there to today, a coveted vacation land crowded with mansions, upscale hotels and restaurants, one that even includes a spa, and endless entertainment for more than 5 million visitors who spend more than $2 billion annually, coming in on the area's approximately 37,000 permanent residents. From cottages renting for less than $100 a week to ones commanding up to $65,000 weekly. One man, all but forgotten, small of stature but gigantic of heart, almost single-handedly brought us here. If you really want to know the Outer Banks, you might want to understand photographer Acock Brown. He was the visionary who literally put the banks on the map, as many have said. A native of the North Carolina mountains, he was, like so many Outer Bankers before him and so many to come, a transplant who found his true self on the banks. He essentially taught himself his photographic and public relations skills, eventually playing a leading role with his associate, Sarah Alford Owens, in making the Outer Banks one of the most sought-after resort locations in the nation. From a dark room in his Manteo home, his photos went far and wide, published in newspapers and magazines across the country. Acock met his bride-to-be, Esther Styron, on an Ocracoke Island dock in the late 1920s. He married his hopes to hers, and ultimately to those of their beloved banks. Their dream lives on. Sure, there's overdevelopment, but the water and beaches, the natural majesty that Acock shot so well, that their feeling crawls into your soul, they live. He was a man before his time, and he loved Dare County beyond anything, said family friend Kathy Spencer. In the parallel time of the banks, where some locals still speak in a wonderful brogue of old England, Acock is right there with us, a pied piper shooting and laughing. You're here because of him. Mystic Sands. The Outer Banks blew Acock away the first time he saw it on Ocracoke in 1928, sand dancing in the screaming wind like banshees, the Atlantic pounding waves on the east and the Pamlico Sound on the west, whipping whitecaps, the breeze hard and smart and wet with the glorious salt spray, fishing boats out there bobbing and working. Acock was 24 years old, whip-skinny tough, of medium height and 130 pounds on a good day, having rolled down from the mainland by way of a brief stint in New York City. He instinctively saw it as all photos, not realizing what it all might mean, just clicking away, digging his bony knees into the sand and snapping away at this pioneer world few outsiders had seen. He was tapping into mystic sands, and a few years later in the World War II days, Courage. Just offshore, German submarines were torpedoing our ships. Aycock worked for the military in the grim job of identifying the bodies of U.S. servicemen, merchant mariners and foreign sailors, later co-authoring a story about it headlined War, a Dead Man's Hand. On Ocracoke, he met Esther, the woman who would become his wife. The Starrens were an old family on the island. Aycock's marriage to her bought him acceptance on the island. Aycock was an old-school romantic, fearless and funny but practical too, one of those rare folk who find themselves at a turning point of history and run with it, a visionary, one able to convey the magic and mystery he was encountering. The magic surrounded him and seeped into his soul as he and Esther moved from Ocracoke to the southern North Carolina coast, then to Manteo. Aycock loved looking at the wild water and beaches. He knew and shot photos of one of the last witnesses of the 1903 Wright brothers' flight. Years later, as he shot photos of soaring pelicans, he watched in awe as fighter jocks tore through the Outer Banks skies in their warbirds, roaring out from their naval base in Virginia Beach to the Outer Banks in under 5 minutes, a car drive of an hour and a half on a good day. He intimately knew the old days on the banks, when most locals still talked in the old English brogue. Hoi toid on the south side, in the enchanting parallel time. He was, in his own way, an anthropologist, chronicling a culture and a way of life fast vanishing, a filter, a lens, a mirror, a closet intellectual with an impish sense of humour and never-ending wonder, almost childlike at times. Pounding out press releases. In 1952, Dare County established the Dare County Tourist Bureau with Aycock as the director. Before the Bureau, Dare's counties and towns had basically competed for tourism business in unorganized efforts. The county officials recognized that Aycock had done solid work in the Morehead City area and on Ocracoke. They also knew his organizational skills weren't the best, but recognized that his visionary risk-taking and his growing network of national contacts might outweigh his organizational weakness. David Stick, one of the founders of the Bureau, became one of Aycock's biggest supporters and friends. Aycock worked hard, and he was lucky, especially in his choice of assistant, Sarah Owens. She was from an old-line Manteo family and helped secure his local contacts. She also had a knack for organization that Aycock lacked. His tiny office was in downtown Manteo near the corner of Budley Street and US 64 and next to the Coastland Times. His desk was shaded by old-school Venetian blinds, cluttered with hundreds of files bulging with negatives. Aycock would sit at his typewriter every day, pounding out press releases, ashes dropping from chain-smoked cigarettes. Owens, 30 years younger and always nearby, matching him cigarette for cigarette. Aycock taught himself photography. He knew he had to do the office work, but he was most comfortable cruising the Outer Banks coastline, stopping often to talk to his many friends and snap photos. The North Carolina coast runs for about 300 miles, the largest segment being the 200 miles of the Outer Banks, from the Virginia border north through Hatteras and Ocracoke before the southern coast of the state begins. NC-12 closely parallels the Outer Banks beach line, the closest thing North Carolina has to an oceanfront highway. Aycock was determined to make the Outer Banks the most sought-after part of his state's coast. He fell in love with that region and the people who lived and worked on it. Aycock knew that tourism could help them. Up and down the East Coast, there were better shooters and better writers than Aycock. He wasn't an artist and never claimed to be, but he was tireless, fast, creative, and yes, gimmicky with his shots, charming newspaper and magazine friends to take his photos and stories nationwide. Aycock's work was paying off. By the 1960s, the Dare County population of 7,500 year-round residents was swelling to 50,000 in the summer, bringing in tens of thousands of dollars. first in flight. Aycock always remained keenly aware of the Outer Banks' unique place in American history. The bookends, The Lost Colony of 1587 and the first powered flight by the Wright brothers on December 17, 1903. Aycock spent thousands of hours shooting photos of the outdoor drama based on The Lost Colony and chronicling through his photos the commemoration of that first flight. In the 1960s, Aycock photographed astronaut John Glenn visiting the Wright Memorial near Kitty Hawk soon after Glenn's orbit of the Earth. Then there is Aycock's iconic shot of the crescent moon rising above the memorial during the first moon landing in 1969. Outer Banks author R. Wayne Gray wrote, "With a portable radio in hand, he snapped the shot at the exact moment when man first set foot on the moon." On October 16, 1972, Dare County surprised Aycock with a day named for him. David Stick praised his friend's work and included one solemn note based on some of his chats with Aycock. "What have we really wrought? And are we, in the process of publicizing and building on the Outer Banks, are we going to end up destroying the very thing that we were attracted to in the beginning?" Aycock kept working on his rapidly changing Outer Banks. The rum runners and moonshiners he had seen almost 50 years before had been replaced by maritime drug smugglers, some of them local, hauling in loads of marijuana from overseas to unload on trucks pulled up in secret spots by the sounds, or the thousands of canals leading into the sounds. Smugglers coming in off the ocean, facing federal boats coming for them, routinely dumped their bales of pot into the sea. A popular T-shirt of the 1980s had a painting of a couple of bales with "Save the Bales" underneath the picture, a takeoff on the environmentalist slogan of "Save the Whales." Aycock died on April 13, 1984, at the age of 79, in his Manteo house on Sir Walter Raleigh Street. Secret no more. The Outer Banks of North Carolina used to be a vacation traveler's secret, the Insider's Guide to North Carolina's Outer Banks reported in the early 1980s. Many Tar Heels and Virginians knew of its getaway, restorative pleasures, but invitations to Nag's Head cottages were reserved only for special friends and family. The guide noted that the banks attract over 1 million visitors each year. That number would multiply in ensuing decades. In the early 1980s, there was hoopla in the Outer Banks real estate world when the first oceanfront cottage, offered by Joe Lamb Jr. and Associates, broke the $1,000 a week rental mark for the summer. Now, that cottage rents for almost $11,000 on its biggest week. One of the bank's top weekly rentals in Killdevil Hills gets $65,000 a week in prime summer season. Many Outer Bankers, long-time residents and seasonal ones, curse the overdevelopment, even while being happy with their chunk of sand and with some of them selling more of it to newcomers at constantly rising prices. Towards the end of his life, Aycock half-joked that the overdevelopment was his fault. "Affordable housing for everyone, from restaurant staff to teachers to doctors, is a huge problem. Dare County's permanent population of about 37,000 residents swells to about 225,000 to 300,000 from June to August. Old-timers and newcomers curse the traffic jams and growing stream of visitors and new residents, as if they could somehow put the genie that Aycock unleashed back in the bottle. Nostalgia rages for the good old days, with that nostalgia, depending on whom you talk to, surfing a sliding scale from the 1950s to the 1980s. That magic can never be recouped, but much of it remains in the sands by the ocean and the sounds, the dolphins playing just offshore and the families frolicking in the sand. These scenes and many others are timeless. They are classic, set in drifting sand by Aycock, who might have known that Constance would remain in the dreamscape he introduced to the world. In Killdevil Hills, there is a road named for Aycock. It leads from the beach road and doglegs across the bypass to Kitty Hawk Bay, past new cottages and old. A microcosm of the bank's culture, Acock knew so well. We have time for an excerpt now of an article from Higher Education, The Life of Young Lee Roberts, and that's written by Matt Hartman. Lee's face becomes a canvas of beet red as he hugs his mom. Then News and Observer journalist and current Assembly contributor Billy Warden wrote in a profile of UNC Chapel Hill Chancellor Lee Roberts way back in 1990. Roberts' mother, famed NPR journalist Cokey Roberts, was in town for a fundraiser, so Warden spent a day with her son, then a Duke University senior. "What an amazing pair they make," Warden wrote. Cokey in her dark checked outfits with her dazzling eyes, Lee in his blue blazer and spiffy tie with his perfectly combed blonde hair. Both of them so sharp, so poised, so reasonable. "I've known that Lee is the late journalist's son since I started on this beat, but until I read Warden's profile, I didn't consider how useful the family context could be for me. Roberts is a reserved public figure. To take a line from my colleague Corey Dean out of context, he is not one to say more about that. But Cokey and Lee's father, longtime New York Times journalist and current George Washington University professor, Steve Roberts, wrote about their son publicly for decades. They even co-authored a 2000 book about marriage and family, From This Day Forward, that was helpfully available at my local county library. What nuggets does the book include? It is there that I learned that Steve missed Lee's first birthday for work, promised Cokey he'd never do it again, and drew the short straw to take Lee and some friends to see the band Foreigner for Lee's 13th. The six of them were probably the youngest people in the building, and I was probably the oldest, Steve wrote. The elder Roberts spent the night listening to a World Series game on a portable radio. So maybe that isn't so helpful, but understanding Lee's upbringing does shine some light on his perspectives. Cokey's father was the former Democratic U.S. House Majority Leader Hale Boggs, and his prominence meant Lee rubbed shoulders with power brokers throughout his childhood. The Robertses had a family saying, "I guess the raisins were a bad idea," that stemmed from Lee and Tom Brokaw's kids throwing raisins around the room on Thanksgiving. Another time, Cokey broke a tradition of Sunday family dinners to meet with Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. "Tell your children that I'm grateful they'll let you come, and tell them that President Kennedy loved and admired their grandfather very much," Onassis told Cokey. The detail surest to capture Tar Heel attention is that Lee didn't just attend Duke, it was the only college he ever seriously considered, and he went over the objections of his father, who preferred the Ivy League. "Being the child of a professional journalist has its pros and cons," Lee told the Assembly. "You learn a lot, but nothing is ever really off the record." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of The Assembly. We hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to tune in next time. I'm Naomi Lambert for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired, and this broadcast is now available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time, and if you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138, and thanks for listening.